Hey guys, how's it going? Okay, well, that's good. Yeah. So, I'm me, Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. What happens is, I do my best to tell you the truth about the lies that they tell about the foreign policies that they have. That's basically the shtick. And man, it's pretty easy for me because everything that they say about what they do is a lie because the things that they do are wrong, and so they have to come up with fake reasons why they have to. So it's surprising there are not more me's out here. It's a pretty easy task, although it doesn't really pay well. There's not much demand in the market for this kind of debunking. I'm not really sure why. Probably just my bad attitude, poor grammar. But anyway, whatever. I'm right about everything, so there's that at least. Today on the show, two former CIA guys. And we just talked with Ray the other day. So, you know, I don't know, man. I'm sorry. This is not the former CIA officer show. But, well, this is Phil Giraldi. And all he ever says is reasons why our government ought to stop killing people. I ain't never heard him say contrary to that, I don't think, yet. And he's got a chip on his shoulder about all the same stuff as me. Like, you know, all of our Middle Eastern policies especially, and Israeli intervention in American domestic politics. So, yeah, man, Phil Giraldi, he's going to be on the show. And John Kiriakou. That's some pretty sloppy writing there, Horton. John Kiriakou is also a former CIA officer. You know, I've never talked to him before. And I'll tell you why. And I'll tell him why, too, later. But the thing that I knew about him first was he went on morning TV and said, oh, come on, the CIA waterboarded three of the most, very worst, most murderous, most guilty for September 11th Al-Qaeda terrorists. So, boo-hoo, cry me a river. And the American people agreed. Oh, they waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, huh? Meh. When, of course, the question is, do they have the authority to torture? Not, what's the worst thing you wouldn't mind happening to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? But anyway, that wasn't true. It wasn't true. And, but then he later came out and said, oh my God, that wasn't true. And now I'm angry because they told me to say that. And I thought I knew it when I said it. But I was wrong. I still didn't pay much attention to him after that because I was still pissed off about the thing when he came out lying. Don't claim you know things when you don't then, dude. But then it turned out what happened was they prosecuted him and put him in prison for trumped up charges, basically, of leaking classified information about torturers. So, the only CIA officer to be held accountable for the torture program was held accountable for talking about it, not for participating in it. And honestly, I guess I screwed up. I should have, like, called Marcy Wheeler this morning and asked her to remind me everything about this guy that I don't know. I don't know if he even had anything to do with the torture program. Maybe he was just a PR guy or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to ask him. We're going to find out. Did 30 months in the pen. And he'll be on the show to talk about that. So that's pretty good. Now, man, I'm really sorry. I was trying to get Yosef Butt, the nuclear physicist, on the show today. Thought we had a deal, man. Well, anyway. That's all right. I'm going to debunk these things myself. Well, Robert Kelly makes it really easy. But Yosef Butt, he's a nuclear physicist. So he can speak authoritatively about these things. About, you know, much of this stuff anyway. And, well, what's at issue especially that I was going to have him talk about is this hype from David Albright and Rogan and Lake over there at the Daily Beast, or, Bloomberg. pretending that there's some crisis at the Parchin military base. And look, a vehicle. It must mean that they're trying to clean up their previous nuclear weapons work. And what you're supposed to do is just defer to them. Oh, wow. They have a quote of an anonymous official saying he has a high level of confidence. Okay. That's funny. Robert Kelly writing at Loblog, Jim Loeb's blog, the former chief IAEA inspector in Iraq. He says, well, that's funny because I'm looking at these pictures and all I see is looks like a couple Mercedes. There's no earth moving or sanitization going on at all. What in the world are you talking about? IHS Janes, which is, you know, the publication of the arms industry, right? Janes Defense. They ran this thing by Robert Kelly as well. Saying, what are you talking about? David Albright. The parking lot of death. Look, everybody, a parking lot. It's a parking lot of significant interest. And next to the parking lot, a building of interest. And check it out. Okay, now in this picture, no cars. But then in this picture, cars. So you see, cover up of Iran's nuclear weapons program. You see? The causation, the chain of logic. Oh, I know what you're saying, that doesn't make any sense to you. But anyway, it does too, if you want it to, real bad. You just have to believe. If you want to know, then yeah, it's not going to do, because in fact, there was never any nuclear weapons work going on at Parchin. It's just a bunch of crap. A bunch of steaming crap. You know, lies told by liars over and over again. Doesn't matter, this has been debunked for years. The entire story hinged on a former Soviet nuclear weapons scientist helping him do it. But that guy was a real human being with a name and a past. And he wasn't a nuclear physicist at all, or even a metallurgist. His specialty is making nanodiamonds for industry. With, yes, implosion systems, but so what does that have to do with imploding a nuke? Nothing, unless you're just trying to make up some crap. Ooh, former Soviet nuclear. See how those words go together in a way that seems like, geez, if they were true, then maybe this would be a thing? Not true. Again, Robert Kelly, the former chief IAEA inspector in Iraq, whereas David Albright is the former nothing. David Albright, not an IAEA inspector, not a nuclear physicist. I don't even think has a PhD in anything. Robert Kelly wrote a piece for Loblog a year ago, half a year ago, in December. And the piece is called The Parchin Puzzle. And it's just a complete debunking. He just goes through all the claims and explains how you're telling me that they put in the bid, got the blueprints, ordered the design, the whole thing was built, and implosion systems were tested within the space of, what, 3/4 of a year or a year or whatever like this is supposed to be, the time frame this is all supposed to fit within. Get the F out of here. How come all we got is a Colin Powell-style drawing of what the implosion chamber might look like? Oh, and that's not how you test implosion systems for nuclear weapons anyway. You do that outside. But anyway, whole thing is a made-up bunch of crap. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So we're going to get back to Iran and the nuclear deal. Some other anti-Iran propaganda. I was asked by email this morning about some anti-Iran propaganda, which I debunked years ago, but 8 years ago. So we're going to have to get back to a little bit of that. Phil Giraldi again, the expert's expert. Who's the best? Well, I'll go ahead and tell you what it is. In 2007, there was all this war propaganda saying that every time a roadside bomb went off in Iraq, if they were being a little bit more specific in their lie, every time a roadside bomb went off in the Shiite part of Iraq, they would say, that was a bomb that came from Iran. It was a copper core, explosively formed penetrator, shaped charge, and the copper melts and is good for anti-armor, basically. And they said, well, we've been fighting Sunnis and their IEDs. Improvised explosive devices all along. But now we're fighting the Shia and they're backed by Iran and all their bombs come from Iran. Well, they never proved that. In fact, they never provided the slightest bit of evidence whatsoever. And in fact, at one point they even claimed they were going to prove it and they laid out a bunch of weapons and the reporters started milling around and looking at them and it was just a bunch of crap and none of it, I don't even think, said made in Iran, but even if one of them did say that on it, that wouldn't have proved a damn thing about how it actually got there anyway, and they called off the press conference. The reporters were asking critical questions. They just canceled the damn thing. Well, the fact is there was plenty of evidence to the contrary that these bombs were being made in Iraq, and I couldn't find it this morning. I think his independent archives are screwed up, man. I'm going to have to double-check and look harder later. But Patrick Coburn, this is when I first started interviewing Patrick Coburn. I'd read him for a while, but I believe one of my first interviews of him was about this. I certainly remember the article from, it had to have been November of 2006. You know, because my brain's pretty good about these kinds of things. And he said, yep, and I went there, and there were the Americans, and they were attacking some Shiites, and they kicked their ass, and then we were walking around, looking around, and there they had in this garage a facility for creating new and improved IEDs with copper cores for anti-armor purposes, whatever. And this was a good, you know, 2 full months before the propaganda war really kicked in that, you know, we're going to pretend that everything wrong in Iraq is Iran's fault, when in fact our government was fighting for the most Iran-backed factions, the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, all along. Their primary enemy was the Sunni resistance to that. But, hey, as long as they never explain who's who, they don't have to explain when they switch sides, right? Works great. But anyway, so my point is this. Phil Giraldi debunked this crap better than anybody in the world. Okay, I've said crap too many times already on the show today, but he did. He actually wrote a giant study for some journal. I had at one point, I went searching through all my documents this morning. I couldn't find it, but I remember it was a PDF, and it had all these charts and graphs and 1,000 footnotes, and it was like, you know, you'd give him another PhD for his work debunking the EFPs. Like, this was, you know what I mean? Like, if it was for an academic thing where it had to be not just prove your case in some kind of polemic fashion, but do a real study and just don't show, prove beyond any shadow of a doubt every bit of information relevant. Blam. War propaganda destroyed. And I couldn't find the damn file this morning. I asked him if he had it and he didn't answer, so I guess he couldn't find it either. But anyway, so yeah, we're going to debunk that, and you're going to get it from the authoritative source, Phil Giralli, former CIA counterterrorism officer, for you today. And it's relevant, of course, because there's new anti-Iran deal, nuclear deal propaganda based on the theory that America's enemy in the Iraq war was the Iranians, not George Bush, was the Ayatollah Khamenei's tiny little pathetic sock puppet doing his dirty work from March 2003 through January 20, 2009. What are you, retarded or something? No offense to the retarded people who gotta know better than that crap. Ah, I said crap again. Sorry. I really need to take a vocabulary course or something. Anyway, so that's coming up on the show. Hey, Cuba. There's good and bad. We're not enemies. Our government is no longer an enemy of the government of Cuba anymore, so that's good. Because, you know, they interfered with, and they're still interfering with, Americans and Cubans' right to interact with each other, because we're human beings, we have those rights. So, but anything done to erode those restrictions, anything done to make America less communist, so our government is not claiming the right to prevent us from associating with Cubans if we feel like it, is to the better. Okay? There are possible negatives, like the empire just kicking the damn door down and taking the place over like back in the bad old days. I don't see how that could be much of an improvement over living in a communist dictatorship. So, you know, here's to peace and an open and friendly relationship between our two countries, and an end to the American empire forever. And complete and total non-intervention in the affairs of the Cubans. Let them have their independence. What's it to you? Let them have it. All right. And then, I wanted to say this on the show today, too. I still predict Jeb Bush for president. And, you know, he even came out and said, yeah, we might have to use torture again yesterday. Are you serious? Would somebody tell this guy to just shut up for a minute? And this ridiculous Iraq war stuff, I don't know. I guess it's possible the American people will just not stand for it, but that's not what I think. Here's what I think. I think Trump is his only real competition, and Trump, I mean, on the right, in the primary, and his Trump will burn himself out at some point. There's too much negative, you know, going against him, and especially that he will look much less electable to the professional political GOP types for going up against Hillary or whoever is the nominee. That's a different argument about who's going to be the nominee on the other side, but electable, electable, electable is all that matters when Iowa really comes due. And I think, we still have many months, and you're going to see... And there are a lot of Republicans, but you're going to see a lot of Republicans dropping out. And Jeb is going to have the money to just stay in. Jeb is John McCain 08. He's the guy that nobody likes and nobody wants because he's the rhino, principle-less, centrist, compassionate conservative. But then they'll settle for him, all right, after everybody else is disqualified for all the reasons that they're disqualified. And so he doesn't have to drop out because he's got the banks, the insurance companies, the oil companies, the arms dealers, agribusiness, the pill pushers, the Israel lobby, and the probably the AARP too, although I don't know, the right half of them all locked up. That is, you know, power in America. This is not a democracy, dude. It ain't no republic either. It's an oligarchy, an evil empire, run by criminals. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow. And thanks, y'all.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So I'm actually kind of nervous. I'm not sure why. I guess I don't usually do debates too much. So I got all nervous before I debated Walter Block the other day. And now I'm all nervous because usually Tom's show posts earlier in the day, but he hasn't posted it yet. But, you know, anyway. The only thing I want people to know about me is that I want you to hate Empire. That's it. I got my problems with Rand Paul, but I don't want to be known as the anti-Rand Paul guy. That is not what the show is about. And, but that's the kind of thing that gets people's attention is electoral politics and name-calling and crap, you know. So, but the deal is, I debated Walter Block about whether libertarians should support Rand Paul, and I say no. And, you know, which, whatever your opinion is, it's not going to change. You're either going to agree with Walter or you're going to agree with me. But I don't know. I guess it's not the kind of attention I'm trying to get, man. I really want you to care about what's happening in the wars so that you can hate them, so that you can oppose them, so that more of us, eventually enough of us, will oppose them, and then they'll stop. So, but anyway, but again, that's my problem with Rand, is that's what he's bad on. And picture the Nagasaki bomb going off in my brain. It drives me crazy. It drives me absolutely crazy. I'm obsessed with the topic, and I can't get over it, and it sucks. But anyway, so it is what it is. Listen to that if you want. Apologies to Ron, Anyway, all right. Man, check it out, dude. I gotta find which tab I'm talking about. Okay. Warnings of jihadists among Syria's rebels came early, were ignored. By Hannah Alam at McClatchy, D.C. Yeah, that's right. You didn't read that in the New York Times. Now, if you're a regular listener to this show, you're saying, damn right. You know why? Because Scott Horton was reading McClatchy and interviewing David Enders from McClatchy from Syria on the show in 2011 and 2012. And what did he say? There's terrorists everywhere. David Enders, I first started interviewing David Enders in 2005, which I had to go back and look. I didn't even realize that. Now, I've been interviewing him for that long because of his incredible coverage of Iraq War II. And I realized that, and it reminded me of our previous conversations from years back. And so in 2012, and you can check the archives, in 2011 probably even, and 12, I would set up the question to him and say, so David, In Iraq War II, the Sunni-based insurgency was mostly the former Iraqi army, the Sunni just guys in the neighborhood, and the tribal leadership working together to fight the Americans. And the jihadists, Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the guys sworn loyal to bin Laden and Zawahiri, they were the smallest amount of the insurgency, never more than 5%. 7% was the highest estimation of anybody who was honest about it that I ever heard. And in fact, that included the U.S. Army. And Enders would say, yes, absolutely, that's right. We're on the same page right now, you and me, Scott Horton, uh-huh. And I would say, okay, now in Syria, we have a Sunni-based insurgency again. Is that the same thing? Where this is the Sunni population of Syria rising up, and only the small percentage are the head-chopping, suicide-bombing Zarqawiites? And he says, no, dude. Right now, the Zarqawiites, the bin Ladenites, they dominate the field. The al-Nusra Front dominates the field. And the reason why is because moderates don't fight in jihads, man. Jihads are for jihadists who don't mind dying, who get out there and kick Syrian army ass. Moderates don't do that. You know what moderates do? Cocaine. Moderates sit at hotels with whores and piles of dollars and tasty drinks to drink. And sit, you know, maybe they launder a little bit of money to guys who fight. And all through 2012, when Hillary Clinton said, we're the friends of Syria. Let's create a new government for Syria. It'll be a government in exile to replace the government in Damascus. And we'll bring together, you know, whatever expats the CIA can put together and give them a bunch of money. And the Saudis and the Qataris and everybody will back them and it'll be great. And then every time they did that, and I think it was three different times under Hillary Clinton that they tried that. Certainly it was twice. They turn immediately around and endorse the Al-Qaeda fighters, the Al-Nusra Front on the ground. This is before ISIS split back off from Al-Nusra, which is just Al-Qaeda. That's all it is. Syrian Al-Qaeda is all Al-Nusra is. And why did they do that? Because they had to have that credibility. That was their only shot at credibility, being a bunch of big fat, cocaine snorting, paid off expats working for the CIA, living in a hotel in Qatar. Why the hell would anyone on the ground fighting and getting killed and killing in the war give them any power? They never gave them any, but their best shot was to say, I'm with you. And they endorsed America's enemies. Again, I'll play this clip a million times, and I'm sorry, I know it drives you crazy, but it just proves the point so well. It's Hillary Clinton from March of 2012. March of 2012. So 1 year into the Arab Spring, she's being asked by the CBS News reporter, how come we're not doing more to help the rebels overthrow Assad in Syria? She's being attacked from the right on this, and we all know that's what she wanted to do. But here she is defending Obama's position. I couldn't have said it better myself. Where's my audio? Why am I not getting audio out of that? Well, the little green bar's going across like there's audio. All right, well, great. No soundbite for you then. Well, anyway, you hear it at the top of the show every day. Well, Zawahiri, Al-Qaeda has endorsed the war, so are we supporting their war? And then she goes on to say, what the hell? Why didn't that play? She goes on to say that when we look at moderate opposition groups that could be a credible replacement to Assad, we don't see that. They just don't exist, man. They're not there. And so anyway, here's Hannah Alam reminding us what we learned from her colleague David Enders back years ago now and ever since. The field is dominated by the Al-Nusra Front. She starts the article talking about when Kerry testified before John McCain, and they agreed that Al-Qaeda and the bad guys are maybe 15 to 25% of the insurgency. And people in the congressional hearing at the Imperial Senate there all laughed out loud. What are you kidding? And then this was the occasion where Vladimir Putin called John Kerry a liar. He said, I'm sorry, I don't know what to tell you, but he's a liar. That ain't nothing but a lie, and everybody knows that. And Putin was right, and John Kerry was a liar. That's as simple as that. And even going back to, they go, well, no, we should have supported the moderates more at the beginning. No, the moderates at the beginning were the Al-Farouk brigades. You know the guy who's on video eating the dead soldier's heart? Really? Oh, yeah, no, they're secular moderates, want to hold democratic elections. And they're cannibals. John McCain's friends from the Northern Storm Brigade admitted to Time magazine before McCain ever went there that they were veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And they're the ones who sold Stephen Sotloff to ISIS to get his head cut off. Use your Google. It's your friend some of the time, you know.
They're also spying on you. Yeah.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys. I'm going to get to interviewing former CIA officers here in a minute. Phil Giraldi and John Kiriakou. Phil about Iran and the lobby and the lies. And Kiriakou about the torture. Oh, so much torture. Jeb says, yeah, no, when I'm president, we're going to torture people again. Well, you know, I already made that bumper sticker months ago. Bring back the torture regime. With Jeb's stupid, ugly face on it. That's my problem, man. I'm always too far ahead of the curve. Well, not always. Anyway. All right. You know what? I got to get back into what the hell's going on in Syria with Phil, too. Yeah, this... Where the hell did that link go? U.S. says it'll create a buffer zone on the Syrian border, but nobody knows how. Yeah, I don't know. I'm getting a lot of contrary indicators. I was just reading one thing about how the military's giving up on... What a mess. The military's giving up on training anti-ISIS rebels. Other than the Kurds, that's who they're backing, the Kurds. Forget the FSA, you know, mythical moderates. The Kurds can actually fight. They can call in airstrikes. They got that, you know, commie cohesiveness on the battlefield, I guess. I don't know. They're worthwhile fighters, and they're fighting for their lives against the Islamic State. And apparently, I don't know that this is true, but from what I read, they were saying... They've had quite a bit of success in taking back, admittedly, small villages from the Islamic State recently. And, you know, if they've got good fighters on the ground and good laser pointers for when they really need help, that can be effective. Was effective in keeping the Islamic State out of Kobani. But, anyway, problem with that is our allies, the Turks... Well, they like al-Nusra, if not ISIS, too, and hate the freaking Kurds, and are terrified that the Syrian Kurds are going to have so much independence that it's going to lead to a real problem with the Kurds in Turkey and in Iraq. And he's already bombing the PKK in Iraq and bombing the PKK in Turkey. I don't know whether, you know, Erdogan, that is, the president of Turkey, I don't know whether he's going to start the full 90s war against the Kurds again, but this has, and I don't know whether the Americans are doing anything more than symbolically backing the Kurds a little bit to just, you know, hold their own for a while until we backstab them worse in a month or what. And they claim they're flying F-16s out of the Incirlik airbase, finally now, to attack the Islamic State. But anyway, I'm not saying I'm pro-war against the Islamic State or anything. I'm just trying to figure out how cynical these guys are in what they say and what they do and who's on whose side. But anyway, you know, I just saw a thing. That's not the last one, is it? I just saw a thing on Twitter earlier. Maybe it was at Counterpunch or something. It's not The Intercept. by Patrick Coburn, and he's another one who's been saying all along in the Syrian war that to back the so-called Sunni-based insurgency in this one is to back America's enemies. That you can call these guys ISIS and these guys Nusra and these guys the Islamic Front and these guys Ahrar al-Sham and these guys the Free Syrian Army. But when I ask them what they think of September 11th, they hoot and holler and clap their hands and say, yeah, more like that. So, that what does that tell you? You know? Other than why the Israelis like them so much and why the Saudis like them so much. And anyway, but why do the Americans like them so much? Hey, it's the same reason that Obama explained to Jeffrey Goldberg back in 2012. He said, you're right, Jeffrey. Regime change in Syria would help weaken Iran. The King of Jordan calls it the Shiite Crescent. He coined that phrase, the Shiite Crescent, that is Shiite-dominated power in Tehran, now in Baghdad, thanks to America and Israel and the War of 2003. Assuming you care, I don't know. And, of course, their ally Assad in Damascus and Nasrallah and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, the little mini-state in southern Lebanon. This is the Shiite Crescent, Iranian power, and, you know, which at least threatens or at least frustrates all of our other allies in the region. And so, especially as Obama's working a nuclear deal with Iran, how to help mollify the rest of the allies? Go out there and say that, yeah, Assad must step down. In fact, that's the companion piece at McClatchy today. The magic words, how a simple phrase enmeshed the U.S. in serious crisis. This one's also by Hannah Lam, and it's about how, geez, Obama wishes he had never said that Assad must go, that he never meant to say that he was going to make sure of it. What does it mean when the president of the United States says that the president of a crappy little country like Syria must step aside? That doesn't have a threat implied in it? You think he could just be the president and just talk like that? Oh, I guess it was the next day his advisor said, but sir, the rebels all love Osama bin Laden. And he went, well, but that's what Israel wants too, right? And I got an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg later. Israel's man at the Atlantic. So President Assad must step aside. And anyway, so we're only at the midway point now. If the Assad government were to fall, if America follows through with its policy of, you know, going along with Turkey and Israel and Saudi Arabia and trying to get rid of Assad in Damascus and destroy the Syrian army, then you're going to have a whole new genocide on your hands. I mean, right now you've got a couple of 100,000 killed already. That's a lot of individuals. But just wait until the de-bothification of the government and the abolition of the Syrian army. You see, the exact same thing as what happened in 03 in Iraq. You know, if you look at it that way, this is as a replay of the Iraq War. America and Saudi and Turkey and Israel's proxy jihadi armies fighting against Syria. That's the American invasion, just in real slow motion. But, yeah, once they de-bothify the government and abolish the army, that's when the real civil war breaks out. And all the Shia and all the Alawites and all the Christians, all the Druze, and the majority of the Sunnis will be fighting for their lives at that point. That's right, the majority of the Sunnis are in on the coalition with the government. Nobody likes Assad. Nobody likes Assad, but they like the Syrian state and the Syrian army, which keeps the head choppers away. Can Americans relate to that? Rallying around the government that's killing Al-Qaeda guys for you? I mean, can you understand maybe the point of view that the Druze might be coming at this from? The Syrian Christians? But America's on the side of jihad in this one? Now, you could say Reagan was just, you know, doped up on jelly beans and had no idea the kind of consequences that would come from backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. I mean, it's Afghanistan on the ass end of the planet Earth. Exile, no man's land from here. They can't get here from there. What harm could they possibly do, some stirred up Muslims, as Zbigniew Brzezinski said? Okay, but now how do you justify being naive like that in 2015? When Obama basically started backing Al-Qaeda in Syria as soon as he was done killing Osama. Oh, Osama's dead? Let's start backing Zawahiri's guys. Hey, Zawahiri, who would you have us attack next? It's completely crazy. And, yet it continues. In fact, what's funny is I just got on this tangent thinking about different things I need to ask Phil about in the short time I have to talk with him today. Let me remind you about one more thing that you need to know. They're threatening to put Chelsea Manning, a.k.a. Bradley Manning, the heroic leaker of the Iraq and Afghan war logs and the State Department cables, in solitary confinement indefinitely over expired toothpaste. And that's not a lie. Look it up on antiwar.com/blog. Call your uncle the judge or something. I don't know.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. First guest today is Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer, executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and writer for the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com. Welcome back, Phil. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Listen, I got a bunch of stuff I want to ask you about, including some of the great articles you've written recently. But first and foremost, I got to ask you just what in the world is going on with America and Turkey and Syria. America, I'm reading, is the Americans, our government, are abandoning the military-trained mythical moderates. They're just going to double down on the Kurds now, the Syrian Kurds. Give them some laser pointers, and let's get to work, and let's kick some ISIS ass. This is the New Deal, and we're moving forward with that. And thank you, Turkey. You're letting us fly out of your Incirlik air base now, so now we can do that. And at the exact same time, Turkey, our ally, our NATO ally, is stepping up their war against our ally, the Kurds.
Right. That's
at the
exactly
same damn
happening.
Time.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you're in supposed fact, to tell me I'm wrong and I don't understand it right and that there's some other thing that's going to enlighten this.
Well, it's funny. I'm working on an article for next Tuesday for the UNS, which it discusses this whole issue in some detail. But it basically is as you just described it. The title of the article is Snookered by the Turks. Basically, they set us up, and they used our war on terror as a way of legitimizing. They're launching a war against the Kurds to help Erdogan in the upcoming parliamentary elections, and so he can get the majority that he wants and continue to run the government. It's that simple. But we were taken. We were completely taken.
Well, but of course, the Americans had a deal with him since 11, right, that we're back in the Mujahideen in Syria together now. So who's really betraying who? We're the ones who are changing our policy from treason to less treasonous than before. Is that it?
It kind of looks that way on the surface. But the fact is Turkey has never played the game straight with us. And we've known this, and that's why it's so insane that they jumped into this deal with the Turks to allegedly oppose ISIS. There was a crackdown immediately about 3 weeks ago when all this started, where the Turks began arresting ISIS supporters, but actually they wound up arresting 800 Kurds and leftists and only about 50 ISIS supporters. So this whole thing was set up right from the beginning to go after the Kurds, because in the Turkish parliament right now, there's a Kurdish party which has enough seats to block Erdogan. Mm. So you accomplish two things at the same time. You get this war going, and you also get rid of this party that is the opposition, and this leads to Erdogan having elections again probably in October, in which his party will again be on top.
Yeah, and just by attempting to conflate the PKK that he's picking a fight with the group in the parliament, when they're not even really the same group, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, obviously, Kurds have connections, you know.
Sure.
The PKK is like a lot of other alleged terrorist groups in that it has a kind of a civil side, which is legal, and they also have an armed side, which is, you know, like the old IRA and that.
Well, there are a couple of different Kurdish parties, right? I can't keep track of them.
Yeah, the whole bunch of them, and some of them are armed and believe in a Kurdish state, and others just want more autonomy within a Turkish state. So it runs the gamut. And in fact, this party that Erdogan is going after pretty much just wants more autonomy, more Kurdish identity within a Turkish state. So he's going after basically the good guys, the good Turks, and he wants to get rid of them, and he's portraying them all as terrorists. He called a couple days ago for all of their parliamentarians to have their immunity lifted so they could be prosecuted for being terrorists.
And now, so
it's incredible.
Is America's policy regarding Bashar al-Assad? To change, to back him now, or to keep bombing him?
I don't think we have a policy. The policy was always that we wanted to see some kind of resolution and that Bashar was not part of it. That was the kind of our policy. But the fact is, you know, obviously this regime change policy is not going to work. So we're stuck in a situation now where the Turks are attacking our own allies, and ISIS is getting a free pass on this, and apparently the Pentagon is furious about it. There have been a couple articles where generals have said that, you know, we were really screwed on this, the Turks really stuck it to us, and yet, of course, the White House is not saying anything.
Now, we go back to Seymour Hersh and his article about what happened 2 years ago. He says Turkey and the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda in Syria, worked together to commit this sarin attack in order to pin it on Bashar al-Assad and get, you know, Obama and McCain to work together to get us to bomb Assad out of power in Damascus.
Yeah, it's completely plausible. And in fact, this current round of violence started with a suicide bombing in the south of Turkey, in which 32 mostly university students were killed. And for me, reading this, it sounds like a false flag. They had this guy who was of Kurdish origin, who they allege is linked with ISIS, but provided no evidence to prove that. And they claimed this guy was a suicide bomber from ISIS and said, well, now we have to go after ISIS, which actually was a lie anyway because they wanted to go after the Kurds. So the whole thing is kind of, you know, it's so crazy. If you were to write a novel with this theme, your editor would come back and say, Scott, get the hell out of here.
Yeah. But in other words, you're saying that suicide bomber could have just as easily been an al-Nusra guy and dead men tell no tales there.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Or he could have been a guy that the Turkish intelligence service kind of set up. You know, that happens
sure.
too.
Yeah. Man. All right. Now, here's some old war propaganda that's coming back up in terms of the Iran deal. We got to talk a lot about the politics of the Iran deal in the next segment. But back in 2000, well, right now at the New York Times, they have a piece about this, and they're showing this ad, bipartisan group of ex-senators to run ads against Iran deal is the headline. And it's an Iraq war vet named Bartlett who's saying he was hit by an EFP, Iran did it. And this is something that you and I have been talking about since this war propaganda was coming out in real time back in 2007. So can you tell us a bit about what's the accusation and what's the truth surrounding Iraqi EFP bombs, Phil?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is they're pulling out all the emotional stops. I mean, this is a wounded veteran, no question about it. But he's been put up to this thing alleging that the Iranians were behind the allegations, if you go back, were that the Iranians were behind the technology, that the technology was advanced and so on and so forth, that could only have been done with their assistance. Of course, that was nonsense. Essentially, we're talking about basically very simple technology that is what was widely known, widely used, has been used, for example, by the IRA, has been used by a number of groups that are considered terrorists. And so that's kind of nonsense. And this attempt to pin it on Iran is kind of crazy. In fact, I think, as I recall, when you and I were talking about looking into it some years back, there was one of the bomb-making factories was in Baghdad, and it was mm-hmm. had nothing to do with Iran. It was being run by local Iraqis, and some of whom were veterans who knew about explosives and knew how to. So anyway, the whole allegation of Iran as a terrorist state, as a state that's been killing our soldiers, these are all kinds of emotional appeals. And we should see them for what they are, which is basically they're essentially bogus.
Yep. All right. Now, I have two recommendations here for the people. They're both blog entries by me at antiwar.com. EFPs are made in Iraq by Iraqis, August 12th, 2007, and Washington Post liars caught. And this is the Washington Post telling the truth and then editing it out and replacing it with might have come from Iran when they had the truth in the thing before they deleted it. And it has links to a lot more sources, but also Phil did a 25-page study or better about this back then, and we're going to find it and post it and post the link to that ultimate refutation of this propaganda by the time this archive is posted. Live audience, hang tight. We'll be right back with more Phil Giraldi after this. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Talking with Phil Giraldi. Here he is writing at uns.com, talking Iran. A successful agreement could restore sanity to American foreign policy. Whoa, what you been smoking, Phil?
Yeah, a couple of the comments made that point that I'm perhaps being a bit fanciful about this whole thing.
And first write, then drink.
Yeah, well, my feeling is that, you know, Obama has actually suffered a couple of reverses on foreign policy. If you look at Libya is regarded by almost everyone as having been a disaster, and that was an intervention by Obama. When you look at Syria, I think everybody figures that Syria and, of course, Iraq has really gone in the wrong direction, that the war against ISIS is not a success, that what's going on in that part of the world is basically a failure for the U.S. government, and that the attempt to up the fighting by claiming the sarin attack was also clearly seen as a fabrication, and that's another failure for Obama. So I'm figuring that Obama, having seen all these kind of neocon-type disasters, if we can finally get a big success with Iran in particular, and also Cuba, I would put it in the same category, there might be a kind of shift in the way the foreign policy establishment in Washington looks at things. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm hoping will happen.
I see what you mean. In other words, because on this show, at least, never mind on TV and the pretended consensus in Washington and all that, since Iran ain't making nukes and it's not a problem, we're just trying to put this fake issue to bed. If we can get this deal done, and then we can very safely assume that the Iranians will abide by it, and that then that should dissipate that level of propaganda. At the same time, being a real victory over, you know, the neocons and the Israelis who tried so hard to stop it. And that then, in effect, you know, we'll be living in a new world where, you know, see, the neocons got really faced down, not just by the people when Obama, like, took their side, like, back in 2013, in the Syria thing, as you mentioned, but faced down and beaten by the president. And maybe that'll be a real shift in terms of just who's allowed to get away with what in D.C. now.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And if you take Iran off the table, who are we going to attack next? I mean, I guess you could say the Soviet, former Soviet Union would be a target, but I don't think even the crazies in Washington are seriously anticipating that. So we've kind of run out of enemies. And I think the fact that AIPAC in this process would be defeated after spending very, very heavily on thwarting this, I think that's significant too. So I think if this kind of goes through, we might have a somewhat of a shift in direction in terms of how people in Washington inside the Beltway are perceiving the options as one goes ahead. Not to say we won't possibly get a crazy Republican in as president, which of course would reverse everything I'm saying.
Yeah, I wonder how bad that would be. I mean, I guess I would expect Jeb to go along with the deal. I don't know. I guess his staff, you know, I could see him sort of in the same position as Junior the way Bolton and all them sabotaged the agreed framework, which I guess Bush was probably, you know, happy for them to do it, although I don't know if it was really his plan. But it wouldn't be that hard to ruin the deal once the neocons got back in. And of course, if it's any Republican, you know, who are they going to have for assistant deputy secretary of defense for policy or whatever the crap? It's got to be the neocons. They don't have anybody else anymore.
Yeah, that's right. That's the real danger with the Republicans. You might get a guy like Jeb Bush who actually might act sensibly in a given situation, but the fact is he's got a lot of baggage.
Yeah.
And the baggage are the people that are whispering in his ear and telling him what to do.
Well, and apparently he's dumb enough that he might as well be crazy at this point, too. He's saying, I'll bring back torture and I'll reinvade Iraq and vote Bush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Get your son killed.
And he's shouting about Iran, and, you know, he's making all the usual noises. And, I mean, to me, this is what's killed Rand Paul, the fact that he's getting bad advice. I think that you know, ultimately, these people double down on what they see as a hard line that is attractive to the Republican Party base. But I'm not so convinced that's true anymore. I think that quite a lot of Americans are really tired of all this stuff. I think Ron Paul demonstrated that there is a constituency out there. And yet they get this bad advice and they make these dumbass comments. And basically they're always doubling down on what are bad policies.
Yep. Now I'm all kind of nervous because I realize that on the Tom Woods show, it just posted my debate with Walter Block about whether libertarians should support Rand or not. I'm not sure what kind of blowback I'm going to get from this. But Rand doesn't believe in blowback anymore. It's radical Islam is the cause of all our problems, so I guess I shouldn't worry.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're not even on the screen. If we have all those people with beards and funny hats that are to blame for everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the deal says exactly what it doesn't say because I need an excuse to oppose it. So,
right, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Well, so now as far as the lobby, it ain't over yet, and you do talk in here about little D democratic activism by the people who know better, which is us. This really is the time. If anybody's going to find the time to call a congressman about anything, this might just be the one. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the other points I make in the article is that, you know, really, I mean, the United States went the wrong way in a dramatic way back after 9/11 when they resolved on attacking Iraq. And Iraq, of course, turned out to be probably the greatest disaster in the history of the United States foreign policy. And that's where we kind of went wrong. And what I'm suggesting here is if we get this one right, it's not going to change things completely, but it's kind of a course correction. It's a demonstration that actually we can get quite a lot by diplomacy rather than by bombing people. And I think that would be an eye-opener for a lot of the people in Washington and also outside Washington who kind of follow these issues. And I think that's the significance of it.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, especially like you say, when the Israel lobby is spending so much money and doing everything they can to create this fake narrative that we're basically handing them H-bombs or whatever kind of nonsense, that if that narrative loses, I don't know about the minds of the right, but it seems like in the great silent majority of just regular folk out there, that that'd be a pretty bad loss for that kind of war propaganda, too, that... You know, it turned out that actually, no, the deal was to restrict their program, not to help them make bombs. What the hell was I listening to on talk radio anyway?
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And particularly as there's, a broad consensus among the public that there were a lot of lies that were used to promote the Iraq War. And if we see kind of the same thing, and it turns out that, hey, this is a good deal. Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon, and tension in the region has gone down considerably. And in fact, even now, I mean, they're talking about possibility of some kind of peace talks over Syria. And Iran is behind that. So there are a lot of good reasons to lessen tensions with Iran and to begin to treat Iran as if it's a normal country.
Yep, sounds good to me. Thanks very much for your time on the show, Phil. I sure appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's the great Phil Giraldi. He's at the Council for the National Interest, UNS.com, and the American Conservative Magazine. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberg, a tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition, $15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom, fff.org/subscribe. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. Next up, it's another former CIA counterterrorism officer. This time, it's John Kiriakou, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, former CIA officer and former senior investigator for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I wasn't aware of that part. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you joining us today. So, this is the first time we've spoken, and I think it's probably pretty likely we will again, considering the kind of things you like writing about nowadays. First of all, I was wondering if we could do a little bit of just to get to know you thing, that perhaps starting with the first time that you were, as far as I know, on TV claiming, I believe you later said that you were misinformed and it wasn't a deliberate lie, that only three people had been waterboarded, and what's the big deal? And I don't know the story that well, John, but my understanding is something along the lines, you found out that that really wasn't true, and then you decided to become an anti-torture activist. Something along those lines.
I tried to make two points in an interview that I did with ABC News in December of 2007. And the two points were that, three points, were that the CIA was torturing its prisoners, that torture was official U.S. government policy and not the result of some rogue operative, and three, that the policy had been approved by the president. Now, the mistake that I made was in saying that the issue of torture could be looked at in two ways. Number one, was it moral and was it right? And I said it was not. It was immoral. But the second was, did it work? And I said that I believed it had worked because the reporting from the field, from these secret prisons where torture was taking place, indicated that it was working. At least that's what we were being told inside the CIA. Now, we know now from the CIA Inspector General's report that was released in 2009, and especially from the Senate torture report, that that was a lie, that the reporting from the field was that the torture was not working. But once that reporting got back to headquarters, CIA leaders were telling CIA employees that it was working and that we were going to continue with this program.
But then, so you were already retired at that point, or they put you on TV to say? Because what I remember that, and maybe this was just because of, this is what stuck out to me the most, but it seems to me, thinking back on it, that the headline that came out of it was, only three guys were waterboarded, and it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You'd waterboard him yourself. Who cares about him? And that was what we all learned from the previous interview, that interview that got this all started.
Well, a lot of the right-wing media picked it up and parsed it and chose to report only what they wanted to hear. That was my first lesson in dealing with the press, that the press is generally hewing to its own agenda, and that the press is ideological one way or the other, and there are very few members of the press who are really interested in the truth. So you're right. What came out of that interview was not what I said, but what a lot of right-wing media wanted to hear, and that's what they repeated.
And that's what I got out of it, was what I didn't want to hear. And I admit, John, that actually I think even after you decided that you were going to, you know, talk about torture in a much more forthright way after that, I still held it against you that, yeah, that's the guy that said that only three were waterboarded or whatever. And it turned out that they put you in prison for the truth that you told about this torture program. So can we now go back to before that terrible interview and who and what you were at the CIA, what you knew about or what any role you had in the torture program or any of that stuff, and make all that clear and then explain, you know, where you went after that interview and before prison?
Yeah. I joined the CIA in January of 1990 as an analyst focused on mostly on Iraq. And I did that for about 7.5 years. I got bored. And I switched to operations. That was a very unusual switch, but I spoke both Greek and Arabic, and I wanted to go overseas. So I moved to the Directorate of Operations in 1997 and spent the next 7.5 years working in counterterrorism. So after September 11th, I was named the chief of the CIA's counterterrorist operations in Pakistan. And in that role, I led a series of raids in March of 2002 that resulted in the capture of 52 al-Qaeda figures, including Abu Zubaydah, who at the time we believed was the number three in al-Qaeda. That turned out to not be true. In fact, Abu Zubaydah was never a member of al-Qaeda. He certainly helped al-Qaeda. He ran their training camps. He served as sort of a logistician, but he never pledged fealty or loyalty to Osama bin Laden. That was just bad information that we have. So I went back to headquarters in 2002. I remained until March of 2004, and I resigned to take a job in the private sector. And then in 2007, in December of 2007, I got a call from Brian Ross at ABC News, who said that he had a source who said that I had tortured Abu Zubaydah. I said that was absolutely untrue. I was the only person who was kind to Abu Zubaydah. I said, I've never laid a hand on him or anybody else. In fact, when I got back from Pakistan, I was approached by a senior officer in the CIA's counterterrorism center who asked if I wanted to go through training that would certify me in what he called enhanced interrogation techniques. I said, I didn't know what that meant, enhanced interrogation techniques. And he said, we're going to start getting rough with these people. And he explained to me what these torture techniques were. I said, look, I have a visceral problem with this. I don't want to be involved. And I had nothing to do with it. But then in 2007, Brian Ross made this call. And I denied that I had anything whatsoever to do with the torture program. And he said, well, you're welcome to come on the show and defend yourself. So that same week, within just a day or two of that phone call, President Bush went on TV and, in response to a reporter's question, said, he looked right in the camera and he said, we do not torture. And then later in the week, see, I knew that was a lie, but later in the week he said that if there was torture, it was the result of a rogue CIA officer. And I thought, my God, they're going to try to pin this on me. Somebody told Brian Ross that I was the one doing this. So I decided, okay, I'm going to go on ABC, and I'm going to defend myself. Now, I went on ABC, and I defended myself with incorrect information. All I knew was what I had been told by colleagues, former coworkers in the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, that the torture did work. That was a lie. That was a lie perpetrated by senior CIA officers, not just to other CIA officers, but to Congress and to the White House as well.
All right. And then so after that, how did you get in so much trouble that they locked you in the pen? Because it's pretty ridiculous when people say that in the entire torture program, the only guy that was ever held accountable was a guy who had told the truth about it rather than participated in it.
Right. The very next day after that interview, the CIA filed what's called a crimes report against me with the FBI, and the FBI began investigating me. That investigation lasted from December of 2007 until January of 2012. They ended up charging me with five felonies. I will admit to you that I made one mistake. I confirmed the name of a former CIA colleague who was involved in the torture program to a reporter who wanted to interview him. The reporter never contacted him and never released the name. But I was charged with a felony count of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. And then for the interview, I was charged with three counts of espionage. And then just for good measure, they threw in a felony count of making a false statement as well.
All right. Now, hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with John Kiriakou. Forgot to say, he's got an article at antiwar.com today. Let's talk about torture. And we're going to do some more of that on the other side of this. Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. Hey, Phil Giraldi just sent that chapter on the EFPs from 07, so we'll post that for you later. The website. Talking with John Kiriakou, former CIA officer, author of this new article, Let's Talk About Torture, running at antiwar.com today. And we got it from Other Words. They said we could. Now, where we left off, you went to prison for espionage for talking to an American reporter, which I think no matter who we're talking to on, you know, about pretty much anything, people got to understand, you know, just how crazy that is right there, that federal charges can be applied in ways where the meaning of words has to be completely destroyed, and then, but they can do it anyway. I mean, they might as well charge you for weapons of mass destruction for having an unregistered handgun. Because, hey, as long as we're making up stuff, I mean, what is espionage about talking to an American reporter? That must have been what your lawyer told the court, right?
It would have been funny if it hadn't been so serious. And, you know, the lead espionage charge, I should add, all three of the espionage charges were dropped, as was the false statements charge. But the lead espionage charge said that I had revealed top-secret code word information to a reporter from the New York Times. And the information had been declassified solely for the purpose of prosecuting me. And that information was that after the 9/11 attacks, the CIA had a program to kill or capture members of Al-Qaeda.
Oh, yeah? That was it?
Yeah. And okay. I allegedly said that in 2008. So apparently that was so top secret protected that I needed to be charged with espionage, which in its extreme form is a death penalty charge. And then I got two other charges of espionage as well. Now, the other two espionage charges were even funnier. I had worked with an analyst who left the CIA to work for Mitchell and Jessen, the two notorious creators of the torture program, the two psychologists. And this former colleague had given me his business card. So a reporter from the New York Times said, hey, do you know how I can get in touch with this guy? And I said, you know, I haven't talked to him in years, but I have his business card. And I gave him a copy of the business card. And then I gave another copy to a reporter for ABC. And I was charged with two counts of espionage for giving them that business card. Now, this is a CIA officer who had never been undercover in his life. And his business card specifically says Mitchell and Jessen Associates, which everybody in America knew had created the torture program. But somehow that business card was so highly classified that it warranted two additional espionage charges for me.
And then what was it that you were eventually convicted of only?
I was convicted of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982. I was only the second American ever charged with violating that law. And what I did was I was working for ABC News at the time. And one of my colleagues there said, hey, do you know how I can get in touch with somebody from the Rendition Detention and Interrogation Program? I said, I really didn't know any of those guys. And he said, well, you mentioned a guy in your book who you saw on the tarmac in Pakistan at an airport when we were transporting Abu Zubaydah. And he says, I'm going to call him John. He says, you know, you called him John. And I said, oh, right, that's John Doe. I don't know whatever happened to him. He's probably retired by now. That conversation put me in prison for 2 years because that officer was undercover and I confirmed his last name. Now, the reporter never contacted this guy, and the name was never released to the public. But it bought me a felony conviction, forfeiture of my pension, and 2 years in prison.
Mm. Well, now, so that wasn't the real reason that they locked you up, though. What was?
No. I maintained, and my attorneys maintained from the very beginning, that the CIA was so angry that I had outed them on the waterboarding issue, and that I continued to talk about torture, that they just asked the Justice Department to find something, find anything with which they could charge me. You know, I want to add, too, there's an awesome book that came out in 2012 written by Harvey Silverglate, who's a professor of law at Harvard University, and it's called Three Felonies a Day. And he argues in this book that we are so over-criminalized in this country that the average person on the average day, going about his normal business, commits three felonies every day. And so if you're the subject of a federal investigation and they really want to get you, they're going to get you, whether it's with the conspiracy laws, mail fraud, wire fraud. I mean, those laws are so broadly written that they can apply to just about anybody on almost any day. And that's really what they did in my case. Mm.
Well, and in fact, a few years ago, they officially legalized, just within Justice Department guidelines, going out on fishing expeditions.
Sure.
And targeting people, not crimes. So
that's right. That's what they do.
That's official policy now. That's just not how they really operate. That's how they operate.
Right. You know, one of the things that really struck me as hypocritical and funny in a, you know, not in a ha-ha way, but in an odd way, is one of the things they did with me was they said, Your Honor, he was seeking to build a business, and he was seeking to capitalize on this monetarily. Well, first of all, that was utter nonsense. They knew what my bank accounts looked like because they had access to them, and I was broke. And I mean, I was literally broke after I went on ABC. I lost my job. I lost my contracts. I lost everything. In fact, it was the prosecutor who went on to a $6 million a year job at a big-name firm in Chicago. You know, it's the prosecutors who end up running for governor or running for president. It's not the people who, you know, allegedly committed these crimes. There was no money involved.
Right. All right. Now, so I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that, but now we have little time to really get into that. But I want to say a couple things from the news here just to bring this current of why this is still important. Jeb Bush will not rule out resuming the use of torture is the headline at the Hill newspaper yesterday. And at The Intercept, there's a piece where they point out an interview with CIA Executive Director Krongard, where he says, quote, well, let's put it this way. it, you know, meaning the stress positions, et cetera, are meant to make him as uncomfortable as possible. So I assume, for, without getting into semantics, that's torture. I'm comfortable with saying that. We were told by legal authorities that we could torture people. End quote. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's going a little bit off script here. The script is what we did, if somebody else did it, might have been torture. But when we do it, it's an enhanced interrogation technique that does not rise to the level of torture, because if it did, they might have to go to prison for that.
Scott, you are exactly right. This is the issue, and this is what we need to be shouting from the rooftops. It's all about the semantics. You've got George Tenet now, Porter Goss, and Mike Hayden, three former directors of the CIA, and five former deputy directors coming out with a book soon, saying exactly the same thing. If we do it, it's not torture. If the Justice Department says it's legal, it's not torture. That's semantics. And the reason why they're so up in arms about this is because this is their legacy. When their obituaries are written, they're going to say that these men were instrumental in implementing the torture program. And they don't want to go down in history as torturers. They want to go down in history as patriots. Now, I don't doubt their patriotism, however misplaced it might be. But we need to call this what it is. It's torture. And we need to accept responsibility for it. Now, if they're of the ideological persuasion that torture is something that they needed to do, okay, that's fine. I suppose we can all agree to disagree on an issue like that. But we can't continue to play games that then finally indicate that it wasn't torture and that it worked. Because it was torture and it didn't work. And those are historic facts.
Yeah. Well, a couple things there. I mean, first of all, though, I'm not certain that's true. I think it didn't work if you assume the premise that the goal was to gain good intelligence to protect the American people, but that's fairy tale, you know, Disney World crap.
That's
the purpose was to hurt this guy until he says he's friends with Saddam Hussein, and it worked perfect for that, didn't it?
That's right. Yes. You know, in the halls at the CIA, while Dick Cheney was leaking information to the press, false information in the press linking Saddam Hussein to Al-Qaeda, in the halls at the CIA, we called that the big lie. And I remember analysts like myself who had spent, you know, most of our adult lives working on Iraq. I remember thinking, surely no educated American is going to place any intellectual value on this at all. Al-Qaeda hated Saddam Hussein more than they hated us. There was nothing Muslim about Saddam Hussein at all. He famously made a trip to Mecca to make the Umrah, the minor pilgrimage, and didn't even know the prayers, and had to have an aide whisper the prayers into his ear. So there was nothing religious or Muslim about him at all, and there was certainly no tie whatsoever between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. None.
Well, in fact, in the two or three weeks before the invasion, Osama put out a podcast urging the people of Iraq to rise up and overthrow the socialist infidel Saddam and fight the Americans, too.
That's right. That's exactly right. It was all a big lie. And it all came out of Dick Cheney's office.
All right. Now, so then the other point is something that is almost unbelievable to me. And I'm sorry I'm keeping you an extra minute here, if that's okay. George Tenet, Porter Goss, Michael Hayden, and several of their underlings, I presume that means their lawyers, they're writing a book together to justify torture. They don't have all the power in that sentence. They don't have a PR advisor who could tell them to just shut the F up about
just
it? This is what they want to do right now?
I said the same thing yesterday to a former colleague. Why can't they just let it go? And like I said, the only conclusion that I can come to is that this is their legacy. This is how history is going to remember them. And they think somehow in their warped little minds that they are going to be able to twist the truth and to twist history and to convince people, you know, who you know, have to be either stupid or so gullible that they just don't know any better, that this terrible program worked.
Yeah, and especially when, I mean, what's the introductory chapter here is, you can trust me, Tenet, and him, Hayden, because we were in charge of the CIA and NSA on September 11th, so we really know what we're talking about.
Right.
That's the other part of their legacy. They're the greatest failure in the history of all bureaucrats in all of humanity.
It really was. It was the greatest intelligence failure in the history of the country, and somehow none of them have borne any responsibility for it.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, now that we're into that, and you were there in some capacity, I want to ask you about the Rich Blee podcast, especially part two. You may be familiar, where Richard Clark, when confronted with just how much George Tenet absolutely knew, must have known about the San Diego group, is just flabbergasted and says, well, man, I don't know. I guess they must have been trying to recruit them. And I can't believe that he lied to me about this for so long, because according to Clark, he and Tenet would talk on the phone like girlfriends late into the night about Al-Qaeda all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And George Tenet was keeping from him, the director of counterterrorism in the White House, that there was real-ass Al-Qaeda in the country. How do you account for that?
I know both Dick Clark and George Tenet personally, and I can tell you that if Dick Clark says that George Tenet was lying to him, then George Tenet was lying to him. And that's just how George operated. He was an intensely secretive person, even at the cost of a September 11th-style attack. Dick Clark was one of the most highly respected, non-ideological counterterrorism professionals in government, anywhere in government, and I mean even on Capitol Hill. And nobody wanted to disrupt an attack like September 11th as much as Dick Clark did. Talk about shouting from the rooftops. It was Dick Clark who had gone to Condi Rice and said, "You're not listening to me. There's going to be a terrible attack, and it's going to be here." So for George Tenet to lie, it really goes to the core of who George Tenet is. And again, if Dick Clark says Tenet's a liar, Tenet's a liar.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Michael Scheuer, your former colleague, has told the story on the show and in print to James Bamford, and it's been told other places where the CIA, where Tenet at the time was director of Central Intelligence, boss of all the different agencies, and CIA kept trying to get NSA to share their intercepts from the Yemen switchboard house, and they wouldn't. And supposedly, at least, CIA had to build their own intercept station on Madagascar, but they could only get half the conversation, and Tenet would never make Hayden share the intercepts with the bin Laden unit. Is that really how business is done up there? Come on, because a lot of this sounds like, you know, I don't know, cover for something or another.
Oh, listen. It was even worse in the CIA's dealings with the FBI. At least we had, you know, mutual respect between CIA and NSA, colleague to colleague. But our relations with the FBI were actively hostile. And I've always been convinced that's why the September 11th hijackers were able to move around the country like they did, because we hated the FBI, and they hated the CIA, and so no information was exchanged. But Mike Scheuer's exactly right. You know, Mike Scheuer's another one who was sort of, you know, shouting into the wilderness. He was warning people as best he could that something terrible was going to happen, and nobody would listen to him. And here the whole time, the operations people probably were on these 9/11 hijackers, at least the ones in San Diego, and you know, those of us who were supposed to be working against Al-Qaeda didn't even have any idea of it.
Yeah. Well, now, so have you read the 28 pages?
No, I wish I had. But here's another thing. You know, Bob Graham, not only was he one of the most highly respected members of the Senate, he was one of the most highly respected members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And if Bob Graham says that those 28 pages would shake our government to its foundation, I believe Bob Graham. And if, you know, if leaks and rumors about Saudi involvement are what's in those 28 pages, I'm going to believe that the Saudi government was involved.
Yeah. Well, listen, I would rather err on the side of conspiracy kookery rather than letting a CIA guy spin me if I have to, if it comes down to it. So what about what could be pretty reasonably inferred here, possibly, if you were to assume that Dick Cheney's mean enough to say, I don't know, torture people to death, maybe he would work with Bandar Bush to make sure that Al-Qaeda had enough guys to get on those planes to carry out their successful attack, because they had some agendas and they like Pearl Harbor attacks. What about that?
I told Paul Jay at the Real News Network, when he posed almost exactly the same question, I said, in my heart, I don't want to allow myself to believe that something like that could possibly happen. But with that said, there seems to be a lot of circumstantial evidence to indicate that it may have happened. At least some version of what you just said may have happened. And we know that the Bush family and the Saud family go back generations. We know that. We know that nobody was closer than George W. Bush and Prince Bandar. I mean, you know, weekends at each other's homes and Camp David and vacations together. So, you know, I've gotten myself to the point where I'll believe just about anything. And until the White House decides to declassify these 28 pages, I just don't know what else people are supposed to conclude.
Yep. Well, I guess we could just bomb Iran. No. All right. Hey, thanks very much for coming on the show, John. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
All right, y'all. That is John Kiriakou. He's writing here for Other Words. That's otherwords.org. And we're reprinting this one today at antiwar.com. It's called Let's Talk About Torture. And he is, let me page down here, at the Institute for Policy Studies. And that's it for the show. Thanks.